And with me now is film critic Roger Ebert. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Since 1967, Roger Ebert has served as the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. In 1976, he teamed up with his rival at the Chicago Tribune, film critic Gene Siskel, to co-host the television series Sneak Previews. It was first broadcast in Chicago, their hometown, and then it was broadcast nationally through PBS beginning in 1978. This movie review show became the highest-rated half-hour weekly series on public television. In 1982, Ebert and Siskel left public television, dissatisfied with the contract they were offered. Since then, Ebert and Siskel have co-hosted the syndicated television series At the Movies, which is broadcast in Philadelphia on Channel 10, late nights on Friday at 1:30. Ebert has the distinction of being the only film critic to ever win the Pulitzer Prize for criticism. He was awarded the Pulitzer in 1975 for his reviews for the Chicago Sun-Times. He also wrote the screenplay for the cult classic Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which was directed by Russ Meyer. Roger Ebert has just completed a new book. It's titled A Kiss Is Still a Kiss, Roger Ebert at the Movies, and it's a collection of film essays, profiles, and interviews. A Kiss Is Still a Kiss is published by Andrews, McKeel, and Parker. Roger Ebert, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's nice to be back on the show. I love this dark little studio that you have here. It seems like secrets come out here.
That's right. Are you satisfied with the move that you made from public television to commercially syndicated television?
Yes, because we have continued to do the same sort of show, and we've more or less doubled our audience. But at the same time, I have a great deal of affection for public television, and we didn't really leave PBS. We never had a contract with PBS. The contract was with the station in Chicago, and the station in Chicago treated us in a way that we didn't like. Essentially, they wanted to take the show and have the right to syndicate it commercially themselves, and then use that money to pour back into their coffers. Well, we felt that we had given it the office, and we didn't want to donate our careers to the Channel 11 in Chicago fund drive. So they told us it was a take-it-or-leave-it deal, and we left it.
Do you feel that you've had to make a lot of compromises on commercial television?
This is going to come as a surprise to you, but we feel we've had to make fewer compromises because since PBS is now funded from the grassroots up in many cases, there was a lot of feedback from some of the smaller state networks that we were reviewing movies that never played in their state. Or there were also shows that had to be flagged because of certain fairly innocent four-letter words or the use of the Lord's name and things like that. On commercial syndications, syndication is kind of the last refuge of the buccaneer. You make the show, you send it out there. If they play it, you're on the air. If they don't play it, you're off the air. Apart from that, you make your own decisions. And Gene and I, in cooperation with our producer, more or less make the decisions ourselves on which movies we're going to review and what clips we're going to use and so forth, so that we don't have some of those restraints.
Do you watch your successor film critics on sneak previews on public television?
Neil Gabler and Jeffrey Lyons. No, I don't. And the reason is basically one of performance. We are doing essentially the same format, both shows. If I were to watch them, I would probably absorb certain rhythms or certain approaches that would not be mine. It would be inevitable. I tend to be a mimic anyway. You know, if you had a Southern accent, I'd be talking with a Southern accent in 2 minutes. So that wouldn't help me. It's better for me to just go on to the show. In fact, I don't watch our show either because I don't want to be self-conscious about what I look like or what I seem like on television. I will watch our show if we need to look at it for some technical reason. But basically, I feel that any thought that I give to how I look to the person on the other side of the camera is going to be negative. I just want to sit there and do my job.
You must be dying of curiosity, though, to see the sneak previews now with Gabler and Lyons.
Well, I have seen it. I mean, it's just that I don't watch it as a regular sort of thing.
Did you ever...
You know, we left... We did not get fired. We left under our own free will. The PBS station continued to have the rights to the title Sneak Previews, and it's their privilege to choose anyone they want to do that job so that there's no resentment there.
Did you ever secretly hope for them to fail after you left?
No, just for us to succeed. You know what David Merrick said, though, you know, it's not enough for me to succeed. My enemies must fail. Well, they're not my enemies. And basically, by leaving for commercial television, we have doubled the number of movie review programs on the air, so that's a great public service.
you and Gene Siskel are rivals, even though mm-hmm. we see you as teammates mm-hmm. on the programs that you've done together. And I really get the impression that you really are serious rivals, that is not just put on, and that the rivalry is probably much deeper off the air than it is on the air.
He works for the Tribune, I work for the Sun-Times. We fight it out every week in two ways. One, in terms of the reviews that we run, and when my review appears versus when his review appears. It would kill me if he had a review on Friday and I didn't have it till Monday. Also, in Chicago, the movie critics also do personality interviews. Well, now, last Saturday night, they screened Body Double in New York, the new Brian De Palma film. And I was in New York to promote this book, and I went to see the movie, and I also interviewed Brian De Palma. Sunday morning, I got a call from my editor. Siskel has De Palma in the Tribune. Well, it turned out that Siskel had figured out Ebert's going to be in New York to promote his book, so he'll probably go see Body Double and talk to De Palma. So Siskel was in Los Angeles on another mission and with Enterprise, got an interview with De Palma and rushed it into the paper. Well, it may seem trivial, but it made me really feel as if he had scored, you know. So I feel bad about that, and I'm glad that, however, last Sunday I had my interview with Paul McCartney in the paper, and then his interview was in on Monday, so that my figuring is he was going to run it the following Sunday and rushed it into print when I scooped him, so that we both wound up being both pleased and angry after the Sunday sweepstakes. And it's like that week after week after week, so that one day a week we do the show. The other 6 days of the week, we are indeed competitors. Chicago newspapers are like that. I mean, you know, it's not just the two of us, it's the two newspapers.
Is it shameful if one of you runs an interview with a person 3 days after the other person did the interview? Because I assume that you have a different writing style, that you'd have asked different questions.
And we have probably different readers, but they sometimes say that really who you're writing for is your editor, you know, and the editor is looking at the other paper. Everybody suspects that his editor reads the other paper more carefully than he reads his own. Now, why do they have it? You know, why don't we have it? And the same thing goes on across the street at the Tribune. So Siskel and I have been both covering the movies in Chicago for 16 years together, and I started 2 years before him. So it goes back a long way. In fact, when I was asked originally if I would like to do a show with Gene Siskel, my answer was, why Gene Siskel?
Would you ever ask yourself, what did you do to deserve such a fate as having to work so closely with your biggest rival?
There could be worse fates. Gene Siskel is intelligent. He's well-informed. He's a good film critic, and I respect him. And when we are doing our discussions on the air, we do them ad-lib, unrehearsed, spontaneous, and first draft for the most part, unless some terrible mistake takes place. And I'm glad to be able to have him sitting across the aisle from me because I get a lot of feedback and we can talk well together. I think I would feel bad if I had to do the show with somebody who didn't seem to be listening to what I said and wasn't responding to me but was just simply waiting for me to shut up so that he could start.
Speaking with film critic Roger Ebert, if you're just joining us, he's the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, co-host and critic on At the Movies on television, and also author of the new book, A Kiss is Still a Kiss, Roger Ebert at the Movies, which is a collection of his essays on film and interviews with actors and actresses and profiles of them. There are different assumptions you make about the TV viewers who watch you and what they want when you're reviewing on television and what your readers want and how they read you in the newspaper.
No, I think that I am basically addressing the same hypothetical would-be moviegoer in both cases. The difference is that on television, I have an advantage in each place. On television, I have the tool of being able to show part of the movie. In the newspaper, I have more words, and I can deal with more of the plot. If you get into television, into describing the plot of a really complicated movie like Body Double, people are going to completely lose track. Last week, we did a show where we reviewed Choose Me, a new triangle film. It sounds like Triangle is a studio. It's a love triangle film with Keith Carradine, Jean-Vivien Bujold, and Leslie Ann Warren. This is a movie in which each of the two combinations is involved without knowing that the third is involved. And even now, I've already confused you. By the time we tried to condense that for television, we were really banging our heads against the wall. So the television gives you more of a direct, here's the movie, here's what it looks like, here's what it sounds like, here's what I thought about it. And the newspaper gives you a little more time to get into some of the details.
Do you get lectured on television about attention span? Because I think that's something that all TV producers lecture people about, but something I don't think happens in newspapers.
Well, of course, the newspaper, nobody has the attention span necessary to start on page one and read everything. They select what they want to read, and they have enough of an attention span to read that. Since the debate on Sunday night, there's been all this talk about attention span because somebody came up with a theory that the audience for the debates only had a 20-minute attention span so that both the president and Mondale pushed everything into the first 20 minutes. I thought that was flattering that people are given a 20-minute attention span. Most commercial television comes in segments of 6 minutes before you get to another commercial. And as a result of that, audiences for motion pictures, I think, have a shorter attention span. So that the lovely unfolding of a plot in a movie like Casablanca is replaced in modern pictures by one sensation after another. In our show, we have an advantage, if there is a short attention span, in that every 2 minutes or so, something different is going to happen. We may be talking for 2 minutes, and there'll be a film clip for 2 minutes, then we'll talk again. So we don't have to worry about attention span. But I do believe television has probably reduced the national attention span. The idea of an audience appreciating the overall structure of a two-hour movie has been replaced by the Raiders of the Lost Ark mentality, in which something amazing happens every 30 seconds.
Because you're on television, you're a very well-known figure. I'm sure people recognize you all over the country. Has that given you any insights into what it's like for Hollywood actors and actresses who are getting bombarded with autograph requests every time they step out of the house?
It has. It's a strange feeling because I didn't become recognizable until I was into my 30s, so this didn't happen at a very young age. Last Thursday in Chicago, I was interviewing Paul McCartney, and I told him that in the last decade of interviewing stars, he was the first one where people were calling me at the office and saying, you know, take me along to meet Paul McCartney. I mean, I was getting like a dozen calls a day. What can I do to meet Paul McCartney? And I asked him how that made him feel. And he said the only thing that helped him keep his sanity was that when he was a kid, he was a fan. And he hung out outside the Empire Theater in Liverpool waiting for the Crew Cuts to come out because they had a big hit, Earth Angel. And they were nice to him. And they all four signed his program. Next week it was Frankie Lane, and Frankie Lane wasn't nice. And he always remembered that. Well, I could identify with that. I was a fan. You know, I still have letters I received from Stan Freberg, for example, and Bob and Ray. And those are important to me. And so, essentially, it's when people recognize you, instead of treating it like some kind of invasion of privacy, gee, you know, nobody forced me to be on television, I think it's sort of a compliment.
Before you became a professional, before you started writing for newspapers or anything, did you have a desire to make movies or to write about them as a critic?
No. Like a lot of people who started to read in the late 50s, I wanted to be a novelist. I mean, the heroes, when I was going to school, may have been film directors like Antonioni and Fellini, but they were also novelists like Philip Roth. Catherine M. Porter just had a new book out at that time. I started reading in high school, and I started reading, I think, at the age of six, you know. But in high school, I came across the works of Thomas Wolfe at just the right age. I think I was 13 and a half. And this image of this tortured, romantic figure writing novels while standing up and writing on the top of the refrigerator and walking through the dawn saying, I wrote 10,000 words tonight. That was me. You know, I went for that. And Kerouac, On the Road, books like that. And when I was 15 and a half, I started writing sports for the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana. A sports columnist here in Philadelphia, a man named Bill Lyon, also worked on the News Gazette at the same time. I covered Urbana. He covered Champaign. He was into Thomas Wolfe, too. And we would work all night on our stories. We're covering some high school football game, but the lead would have to be perfect. Every word would have to be filled with the passion. You know, Thomas Wolfe covers the Urbana Tigers and the Champaign Maroons. And during the game every year when Champaign played Urbana, you know, it was like Dante was covering it, especially if you lost.
So that's what you started doing for your writing. When did you know, okay, it's movies?
Well, I got into the University of Illinois. I first of all founded a little weekly political and literary paper, which went broke after a year. Then they let me onto the Daily Illini, and I got a weekly column there that I began to use to write about the movies and other things. But I was a graduate student in English when I went to work for the Sun-Times. I was a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago, and I was a feature writer at the paper. not really thinking of myself as pointed toward movies, although I went to them all the time. And then the film critic retired, and they gave me the job. It was a bolt out of the blue. It was pure good luck. So suddenly I was a film critic. And when people say, what does it take to be a film critic? I think the easiest answer is an opinion and a place to publish it.
But it takes more than that. I mean, you have to, I think, have a passion for movies, don't you? And also have seen a lot of them and understand them well.
Yeah, I think that would help. I think it's extremely important also to be in touch with your feelings about the movies. I don't want this to sound like Leo
Biscaglia
meets Pauline Kael, but actually, now that I brought up Pauline Kael, she gave me some advice in 1967. She said, I go into the movie theater taking in everything that I am and everything that has happened to me and everything that I know. The movie happens to me, and then I write about the difference. In other words, what changed? How did I feel? And then in addition to that, you have things like plot, what you thought about the director's last film in comparison with this one and stuff like that. But basically, I'm not a scholar and I'm not an academic. And what I'm doing is retailing a subjective emotional opinion, which means there's no right and wrong. There's just how I felt about it and how you felt about it. And here's mine.
Now, you've written a movie also. You wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, yes. How did you get to do that?
That was one of the most interesting experiences of my life. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about Russ Meyer. Well, I'd gone to see Russ Meyer's film, starting with The Immoral Mr. Tease in 1960, and particularly the movies Lorna and Mud Honey, which came out in 64, I think, in 65. And then there was Motor Psycho and Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. And then Meyer was written about on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I wrote a letter to the editor. I said, at this point, I was the film critic of the Sun-Times. And I said I was glad that he was finally getting some recognition because he was sort of an unsung talent. The next time he came to Chicago, he showed me a couple of his new movies, and then 20th Century Fox, and we talked, and we found that we could talk to each other. 20th Century Fox asked him to do the film version of the sequel to the awful Jacqueline Suzanne novel and not much better movie, and he said that he didn't want an ordinary, experienced screenwriter who would turn it into just another movie. He wanted somebody who saw things his way, and so he called me in Chicago and asked me to write the screenplay, and I took the job. Went out to Fox. We did the movie in 6 weeks, and it's a very strange film. It's overcrowded. There are too many characters, too many incidents. Things are happening in an unpredictable and strange way, and yet somehow it works as a movie. There are people who don't like it, of course, but it continues to play. In 1984, it's on midnight programs and in revival theaters, and it was almost as if for 6 weeks the inmates took over the asylum. There we were in the writer's building at 20th Century Fox, laughing maniacally and making up this movie as we went along.
What are some of the most ridiculous things that you put into it and the little touches that you still really love?
Well, for example, somebody today, I was at a bookstore signing copies of my book, and somebody said, I remember that scene when the television talk show was interrupted by the guy who committed suicide by falling on stage. And I said, but I bet you don't realize that was a quotation from Citizen Kane. And he hadn't. And, of course, nobody has. But in Citizen Kane, you know, the opera singer is performing, and then the camera goes straight up into the wings, and there were the two stagehands up there on the catwalk, and one holds his fingers to his nose and looks at the other. In the movie, the all-girl rock trio was singing on stage, and then the camera goes up, and there's the boyfriend of one of them, and he falls on the stage and tries to kill himself. Well, that was a little, I mean, doesn't make the movie good or bad, but it just indicates that we were pushing things in through every crevice that we could find. One of the things that people remember from the movie is that the hero, Ronnie Z-Man Barzell, the teenage tycoon of rock, is revealed at the end to have been a transvestite, to have been a woman all along. And we didn't think of that until we got to that scene, which is how the movie was written. You know, up until that point, in my mind and in Russ's mind, he was a man. And then Russ says, we need something very sensational right here. And I said, what? And he said, I don't know, but it really has to blow them out of their seats. And I said, well, what can we do? And he said, I don't know. And I said, I know. He's been a woman all along. And Russ said, perfect. And so we made him a woman. It's inconsistent with the rest of the movie, but so what?
Well, I guess what you're going for is something sensational and fun, right?
Yeah. We love the movie so much that we hated to end it, and so it ends with a quadruple wedding plus an epilogue. I mean, people are on the edges of their seats for 8 minutes. You know, is the movie over yet? You know, and it keeps going on, and there's another 3 or 4 minutes still to go. It's a strangely structured film.
I think Leslie Fiedler wrote an essay about the movie, didn't he?
Leslie Fiedler did write an essay about it. I met him out at Boulder at the Conference on World Affairs, and he liked it. He liked it. Some other critics have liked it. Richard Corliss of Time and Film Comment picked it as one of the 10 best movies of the 70s. And you can see, of course, that as the proud author of the screenplay, I remember these arcane details and have forgotten the dozens of critics who thought it was an awful movie.
Do you think that having written that movie and seen it produced has given you insights into movie scripts that you otherwise might not have had?
Yes, although I do not claim to be particularly wonderfully expert. But going through the studio experience, starting with a one-page outline, working with a producer-director, working with the head of the writer's department, seeing how the director would interact with the head of the studio, looking at the casting process, looking at the sets being built, watching the movie being photographed, watching it being edited, and seeing it being promoted, gave me a practical opportunity to go through one movie, even if it was maybe not the most respectable movie ever made, from beginning to end, from the inside, which was good experience in terms of any movie.
A lot of movie review readers criticize film critics because if they really knew anything about movies, they'd be making them themselves. And that's a criticism that's leveled at all critics in movies, painting, music. Do you think it's something that can't be said about you? You did a successful movie, but do you think that it's a valid criticism?
No, I think it's totally irrelevant. The job of the critic is not to be a director or an actor or a musician or a painter. The job of the critic is to be a well-informed, articulate member of the audience, period. And nobody else in the audience can probably paint that painting or write that opera either. But that's okay, because they can sit there and have the experience. I'm writing for the audience and not for the filmmakers.
Speaking with film critic Roger Ebert, did you go to a lot of movies when you were a kid?
Lots and lots and lots. And oddly enough, yesterday I was asked, what was the first movie you ever saw? And I think it was probably A Night at the Opera.
Really?
With the Marx Brothers.
What a great first movie to see.
Yeah. Then there was some movie named Margie where the two women were in their upstairs windows, two neighbors talking to each other about some guy they were both in love with. I've never seen that movie again, but I remember that detail. And then, of course, by the time I got into grade school, there was the Princess Theater on Main Street in Urbana with a double feature every Saturday for 9 cents, plus 5-color cartoons, the newsreel, the Batman serial, the ads for the local retailers. And once a year, Dan Dan the Yo-Yo Man would come around, you know, and have a yo-yo contest.
Would you go to the movie every Saturday, no matter what was playing?
Every Saturday. Every Saturday. Well, it didn't matter what was playing. The same thing was always playing. There was always a Western with either Rex Allen, John Wayne, or Gene Autry, or Roy Rogers. And there was always a comedy that either seemed to be the Bowery Boys or Abbott and Costello.
Did you always wonder why there weren't really horses and cowboys in your neighborhood?
Never occurred to me.
Okay.
Did you?
Yeah, well, I used to think that obviously the world took place like Westerns, and I was always quite puzzled about why.
This is kind of your neighborhood.
Your
neighborhood was a holding pattern.
That's right?
Right. And then after you graduated from this dreadful existence called childhood, you would have your own horse be assigned to you, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Were there movies that you started to define yourself by? You know, like, I love this movie, and this movie really says something about who I am.
That happened to me as I was in the last years of high school and the first years of college. There were art theaters in Champaign-Urbana, and also the university had a film society, and I started going to the Angry Young Men films like Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, which, frankly, you know, as a high school kid in Urbana, I had very little in common with this Borstal boy, played by Tom Courtney, but to me, you know, that movie was my story. It's the Bonnie and Clyde line, you know, where Clyde says, you know what you did? You told my story. I went to see La Dolce Vita by Fellini, and that movie has been a touchstone for me because when I saw it in 1960, there was this 30-year-old journalist in Rome leading this unbelievably glamorous life with all these celebrities and staying up all night and going to orgies and having all of his philosophical friends around him and his wives and his mistresses and miracles and stories to cover. When I saw it again, and I've seen it every 10 years, in 1970, it was somebody about my age, only he was leading a more interesting life than I was, I thought. And when I saw it again in 1980, it was somebody 10 years younger than I was, and he had a lot of problems that I had outgrown.
Hmm.
So Marcello, the character in the movie, stays the same, and I can kind of measure, you know, my thoughts about the character as time goes by.
Do you remember when you first started seeing avant-garde movies and new wave movies?
Well, that would have been about the same time. I remember that in the early 60s, the movie-going audience seemed to be more permissive toward really strange off-the-wall movies than they are today. And we would go to see Hiroshima Mon Amour or Last Year at Marienbad. I remember from 22 years later, I remember standing in the rain in line to see Last Year at Marienbad. And we were talking, my friends and I, you know, Time doesn't understand it, Newsweek doesn't understand it, nobody understands it. And we thought that was great. Today, I think people go more for films with visceral, with direct visceral or emotional experience. And the films are easier, deliberately easier to understand. In the 60s, and up, I would say from, let's define a golden age, from La Dolce Vita in 1960 to Days of Heaven in 1974, or maybe Taxi Driver in 76, filmmakers, young American filmmakers, were trying to make the great American film. They were trying to hit an artistic home run. Now, in the last 8 years or 9 years, they are trying to make the great American box office hit. And the hero now, instead of Scorsese with Taxi Driver, is Spielberg or Lucas. These are good directors, too. But they're trying to make a movie for 100 million people rather than to make the greatest movie in your lifetime.
Do you find that you've lost your patience at all for experimental movies?
You're talking about, now we're talking about, like, shorter films. Jordan Belson, Stan Brakhage.
Well, sure, that, but also more ambitious. Though I can't really think of what feature-length film avant-garde would be now.
Well, I can name a couple of strange examples. My Dinner with Andre. Which is not avant-garde in a sense. I mean, two very understandable people have a conversation over dinner, but it was really a radical movie to make a movie like that. There's a new film out called Choose Me by Alan Rudolph that has a very, very strange narrative pattern to it and doesn't follow. In every scene, there is a surprise. Something happens that doesn't necessarily follow from what had already happened. There are occasionally films that come over from Europe that seem to be pushing the boundaries a little bit. But in general, the directors today are more conservative in narrative than they ever have been. And also, they're more conservative visually. Occasionally, you get a really stylish film like Diva. But in general, the directors today make more or less realistic films with natural lighting. The horizon is level. The camera is more or less pointed from a logical point of view. And the story is the thing. And what I miss and what I was able to see in a movie like Choose Me is the stylistic invention of the going back to the 30s and 40s, film noir, expressionism, tilt shots, strange lighting, shadows, patterns over the face of the characters, side lighting. Whatever happened to side lighting, you know, where half of the face would be illuminated, the other half wouldn't be, which often made for such dramatic studies of the faces of stars. Dramatic music, illogical light sources. All of these things have been lost, and today all movies look like, a lot of movies just look like television.
Maybe that's because of this, where they're going to end up.
Maybe that is, and maybe that's literally the truth, that they are directing for the eventual television and cassette sale.
Yeah, how do you think that all the new home entertainment technology is affecting the movie industry?
Well, the movie industry seems to think it's a good thing. This year, 1984, more different people are going to go to the movies than in any year since television came in. They're looking at a 400 and plus million dollar year, or I should say billion, I think. Well, anyway, billion, million, what difference does it make?
Hey.
They're looking at their best year in a long time. And they say it's because cassettes, which are usually rented by older people, by that I mean anyone over 25, are getting people interested in the movies again and informing them on who the new stars are and who the new directors are, so that folks in their 30s and 40s who were sitting at home not caring about the latest movies now rent An Officer and a Gentleman. They see Deborah Winger in it. They like it. Terms of Endearment comes out. They know who Deborah Winger is. So that the marketing people seem to think the cassettes are having a synergistic effect and getting some people back into the theaters. My feeling is also that most theatrical movies are made for teenagers, for the 15 to 20-year market. And so we get all of the teenage sex comedies and the action pictures and so forth. And that if we're going to have films with more mature and adult themes, they are sometimes going to have some of their success in video cassette. So that, for example, last year's The Right Stuff, which just no matter what they did, didn't make it at the box office. They sold it hard, it got good reviews, but it didn't sell, is now the number one renting cassette because people are watching it at home. Well, that's the good side. The bad side is that you can't really experience a film unless you see it with a large screen, with good sound, with a picture that's bigger than you are, and sharing the experience with a lot of strangers. That's the best way to see a film. Television is the second best way.
Will you watch movies at home?
I own a cassette recorder. I have only seen two movies on it. I use it primarily to tape record things on television. Like True West, I wanted to see Malkovich in the PBS production of True West. Well, I recorded that, and I have it, and I'm glad I have it, you know. That's television, and that's good. Television can be very good. And at what television does. But television cannot give you the feeling that you got in a movie theater watching that first test flight in The Right Stuff.
I think one of the reasons why a lot of people don't go to movies that much anymore is because the screens are so small. If you're going to one of these twinned or quadrupled or octupled type theaters, and some of the other theaters are really noisy or dirty.
Well,
the sound's bad. I've been going to all these theaters where the sound's terrible.
The projection is
no good. The projection's bad.
Yeah. It's a problem. You know, I can't deny what you've said. I guess if you're really concerned, you will go. Everybody knows the best theater in town to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Or good theaters, don't you?
Yeah, except that they're always like twinned right afterwards. You know?
Right after you find
the best theater is always subdivided.
Uh-huh.
And then after it's subdivided again. It goes from 2 to 4, so it's hard.
Well, that would have been a trend, but now the theater chains are beginning to build slightly larger theaters again, 1,200-seat theaters. You'll never again see a movie palace with 3,000 or 4,000 seats. Those are out. They're impossible to heat. The balconies make the heating bill just incredible. So movie theaters are more or less limited by the size of a main floor, which seems to come in at a top speed of around 1,200 or 1,400 seats.
Yeah.
But they are now building those theaters because they're looking for the Ghostbuster, Indiana Jones-type movies that have the million-dollar weekends.
Of course, there are the art houses that have really nice screens and everything, but if you want to see a good sleazy movie or something, you have to go to a really small screen to see it. I'm speaking with film critic Roger Ebert, and he's written a new book. It's a collection of his essays on films, and it's called A Kiss Is Still a Kiss. There's so many movies now that are being obviously marketed for the teen audience. Do you feel at a disadvantage when you're reviewing those? Because they're obviously not meant for you, an adult, anyways.
The good movies can be appreciated by anyone. And I gave good reviews to movies like Purple Rain with Prince. And even, lo and behold, Revenge of the Nerds. Now, I'm not recommending that movie. I mean, I don't think anybody should rush out and see it, but it was a kind of a funny movie. And I didn't have the slightest bit of difficulty in relating to it. When it comes to teenage sex movies, which basically involve teenage boys being rejected by their girlfriends and going to Tijuana where they impress every prostitute in Mexico with what wonderful lovers they are, or movies in which they seduce their French tutor or vice versa, these movies strike me as being very depressing, and I review them from a sociological point of view, with the knowledge that most teenagers are not going to be reading that particular, you know. If you're going to go see My Tutor, you're not going to read my review first. So it's just a sociological phenomenon, a loss of innocence.
Your mom will probably be reading the review, right?
Yeah, while you're going to the movie. Yeah.
Do you want to influence parents' opinions about what movies their kids are going to? And would you like to see parents influence their children in their movie-going habits?
Well, I would like to put out information about the movies. I think that there are some R-rated movies that kids under 17 are definitely going to by the hundreds of thousands. And in many cases, maybe they should see these movies, especially if their parents are willing to discuss them with them. And an example would be Purple Rain, once again with Prince. Now, every kid in America, well, not every kid in America, but lots of kids under the age of 17 are Prince fans. They want to see this movie, and they're not going to find it that hard to get in, even though it's R-rated. When they get inside, what is likely to disturb them more than the sex, nudity, and violence is the depiction of Prince's home life, where he has a drunken father who beats up his mother. And this is handled in a pretty heavy fashion. This is an issue that exists in the lives of some kids, and most kids at least have friends who are not unfamiliar with unhappiness at home, let's put it that way. For very young children, we're talking now maybe grade school kids, those scenes could be very disturbing, and I don't think that there's any reason why they should see them. For 14, 15, 16-year-old kids, a scene like that discussed with the parents can be much more meaningful than some really dumb PG-rated movie about everybody going on vacation to Fort Lauderdale and getting drunk. You know, oftentimes the PG-rated movies are worse for the kids, if you will, than the R-rated movies, because the PG movies are insults to their intelligence, whereas the R-rated movies, for in one way or another, are at least dealing with genuine issues.
Did your parents try to influence your movie-going habits?
You got to remember that when I was going to the movies, most movies were seeable by most people.
Yeah, but there were horror movies and things like that that parents might not approve of, even though there wasn't nudity or explicit violence in it.
I think I had a real good relationship with my parents about the movies. I went to a lot of movies. And then there comes the time in everybody's life when you just go to the movies that you feel like going to. Let's face it. I mean, isn't it true that you occasionally went to some movies your parents didn't know you saw?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It just happens that way. I mean, it's part of growing up. You know, you go to that first time your parents drop you off at the multiplex so you can see Oh, Heavenly Dog starring Benji, and you sneak in to see Saturday Night Fever instead. That's one of the initiation processes into adulthood.
What were the big teen movies when you were 14?
The big teen movies? When I was 14, that would have been in 1956. That would have been pre-Frankie and Annette. You had Elvis Presley, you had Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, you had beginning to have in that period Sandra Dee, you had Doris Day, we can get back to Doris Day if you want to, and you had Pat Boone. But I didn't really go to a lot of teen movies. For some reason, I was more interested in the real stuff. But I feel that one of the people who, if I had to make amends for anyone who I have wronged in my career as a film critic, first on my list would be Doris Day, because in the 60s, when she was making those movies like Where Were You When the Lights Went Out and movies of that sort, suddenly it was the Woodstock generation. Everybody was a hippie, and Doris Day, with her squeaky, clean, freckled face, was an object of fun and ridicule. You remember those jokes about, I think it was Lenny Bruce who said, I've been in Hollywood so long I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin. Doris Day, I've been getting into Doris Day a little bit recently. I've listened to a lot of her records. I've looked at some of her old movies. She started at the age of 16 as a big band singer on the road with Les Brown. She has a remarkable group of recorded songs available if you ever want to listen to them over her career. She was in movies like Love Me or Leave Me, movies like Young at Heart with Frank Sinatra, which to this day has some really appealing moments in it. I remember when I was a kid, I loved her in Please Don't Eat the Daisies. I think she was a very, very talented actress and singer who needs to be revived for a new generation and honored for what she did rather than for being attacked for the fact that she was not Joan Baez in 1968.
I also heard in The Man Who Knew Too Much mm-hmm. recently and mm-hmm. was really startled at how good her performance was.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't defend casting her in Love Me or Leave Me, which is the story about Ruth Etting. I thought she was really misplaced.
Well, I mean, if you're going to get technical. But do you have the soundtrack?
No.
Forget about the performance. Just listen to the soundtrack. Forget about Ruth Etting, which is also important, if you're going to get anywhere with Doris Day. And just listen to the record. I have it at home. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that you're not doing Dogs of the Week regularly at the movies, do you still make a point of going out to genre films and keeping up with the kung fu movies?
There is no such thing right now as a kung fu movie to keep up with.
Really?
There are still kung fu movies. They play triple features in big cities, but there are no recent kung fu movies that are of particular interest, except for an occasional experimental larger budget film by somebody like Chuck Norris or Scott Glenn. Scott Glenn was in a picture a year ago where he went to Japan and learned some kung fu. It was a pretty good movie. We felt, in terms of the dogs and stinkers of the week, that we had reached the end of that particular rope. People like you were telling us, why don't you ever pick on good movies for the dog of the week? How come it's always some helpless little kung fu film? That was good advice. And basically what was happening was the end of the show was being wasted on us slapping our hips and chortling over some movie that nobody else would ever see. So our new strategy is, and this is an example of some of the freedom that syndicated TV gives you, because the guys on PBS are still, you know, crawling into the balcony with that dog. We have decided if we have a stinker of the week, it will be a major movie. And we will say, you know, this is such a bad movie, it's a stinker. When we don't have a stinker of the week, we will do a major movie that is that bad. We will do just a regular fourth review. Or we will do something we call an X-ray, which is a little essay on some trend or some star or some development. Didn't you get kind of tired of all those kung fu movies? They have condemned the theater where we used to see them all.
So that's the real reason, isn't it?
McVickers they looked it over and decided it was going to fall down. You knew you were in trouble. Siskel and I, we always taped the show on Thursdays. And so Wednesday night would come around, and we wouldn't have a dog of the week. Now, in the old days, we both had to have a dog of the week. There were two dogs every week. And so we would flip a coin, you know, and go down to the McVickers Theater, which always had three movies for $1.25 or $1.50. You know you are in trouble, as a general rule, when you walk into a movie theater, and most of the customers are sitting on the backs of the chairs with their feet on the seats. And not because they're rude, but because there are other customers down there on the floor that they don't want to get too friendly with.
Right, with more legs than they have.
Yes, with the number of legs divisible by four.
Okay, so you have no theater left and no reason left to keep up with those movies.
You're acting as if we have lost track of some valuable genre. I think there are still plenty enough bad movies around for us without going to see kung fu every week.
Do you ever go to pornography movies just to kind of keep up with the conventions of that genre? And to see if there's any crossovers?
The last hardcore porno movie that I saw was Debbie Does Dallas. I feel that eroticism depends largely on character and situation, and that the less character you have and the more explicit photography you have, the less erotic it's going to be, until finally you're looking at gynecological training films. I feel that recently I've been hearing about some porno actresses. For example, Brian De Palma was telling me about Annette Haven, who he was originally considering as a star of Body Double. Then eventually he didn't cast her. And he was telling me that she considers what she does to be a political statement, and that she has a question and answer session at all of her live performances, and that she's trying to turn people's attitudes around, and she's very serious. There are a couple of others that I've heard about, and I have a feeling that maybe I should go spend a weekend looking at porno and see what's happening. I know the budgets have gotten larger, and some of the actresses and actors are said to be better. But it seems to me that the problem, you have a built-in dramatic problem when the payoff of each scene is something that is not, to me, intrinsically interesting. See, a scene should lead to a dramatic climax instead of to an actual one, in a way. And when you're interested in these characters, suddenly you're looking at all of this plumbing. You know what I mean? There's a shock value the first time you go. You think, oh, my God, they're really showing that. You know, after the 10th time, you're thinking, oh, my God, they're showing that again.
Okay, but you might go just to see, if the genre's changed and if there's anyone worth scouting out, actors, directors, writers?
I should. Of course, you get into the old catch-22. Now that I'm on television, everybody would know who I was.
Right, that could be very embarrassing.
It's the Michael
right?
Caine line. I have an interview with Michael Caine in my book, and he says one of the problems of being a movie star is you can't go into dirty bookstores anymore.
Well, do you ever find yourself going to a movie, not necessarily a pornographic movie, but just a bad movie, a movie that smart people aren't supposed to be going to see, and feeling like you should apologize to the ticket taker and explain to the person sitting on your right why you're there, that it's for business?
No, they all reckon that you're on the job.
Right. But they wouldn't do that for pornography, huh?
Pornography is a strange thing. It still has the power in our society to make people wonder. And also the guilt. See, the fact is, I don't know that anyone else in the theater would care that I was there. It's just what I might think about what they might think.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guest is film critic Roger Ebert, who's film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, film critic for the television movie review program At the Movies, and author of the new book, A Kiss is Still a Kiss, which is a collection of his essays about films.
Essays and also interviews, mostly interviews, in fact.
In the book, you interview a lot of film stars, one of whom you describe as your favorite actor, Robert Mitchum. Mm-hmm. Why is he your favorite?
Not for a logical reason, perhaps. But then again, this is all subjective anyway. Robert Mitchum was the first star that I interviewed was John Wayne, who was in a category all by himself. But John Wayne was more like an icon. Robert Mitchum, who is a little more scandalous, a little more seedy, has been in more film noir-type pictures rather than always playing the hero, struck me as being the only living actor I was ever likely to meet who would contain within himself the aura of a legendary person like a Bogart or like a Gable. I mentioned in the book that I was watching him shoot a scene in Los Angeles one day, and I was standing over on the side. He was lighting up a Pall Mall and getting ready to go into the shot. And I thought to myself, remember this moment, because this is the closest that you're ever going to get to having been at Warner Brothers when Bogart was there and when Cagney was still working and people like that. Mitchum has the stuff of legend about him, and that is important to me.
Did that make it harder for you to interview him?
I've never had any trouble interviewing Robert Mitchum. In fact, my favorite piece in the book is the scene where we start out in the McKeesport Holiday Inn, and we're going to drive 15 minutes to a movie location, and 2 hours later we are in Steubenville, Ohio. The key to talking to Robert Mitchum is you must not expect to ask a question and receive an answer. It's stream of consciousness. And the way that I write the pieces about Mitchum whenever I interview him is just simply to try to duplicate for the reader what it was like to be there. I try to pay very close attention to the dialogue, to the nuance, to the timing, to word choices. As Mitchum who is a very brilliant man with a very good sense of humor, kind of reacts to the comedy that's going on around him.
It's interesting you do that, yet you don't use a tape recorder, and I don't understand how you could keep all of that either memorized or written down as quickly as somebody would talk.
I've never been accused of misquoting anyone. I think I have a pretty good memory. And what I try to do in these pieces, you know, in the conventional print interview, it seems like there's a monologue going on. This guy is, whoever it is just talking to you, and he's telling you everything that you need to know, and it's all very important, and here it all is, and then the piece is over. I feel it's more important to occasionally include everyday speech, small talk, timing, body language, other activities going on in the neighborhood, significance of emotional state and things like that. And when I have written what I consider to be a good interview, it will read a little bit like a little play with stage directions and dialogue and parts where nothing important is being said, but maybe some character is being revealed.
You've interviewed a lot of stars in the years that you've been writing about movies. Do they ever make ridiculous demands of you about what they will or won't do, what they won't talk about? And if that happens, how do you handle it?
In general, no, they don't. In the book, there's an interview with Jerry Lewis at the Cannes Film Festival. He got out a tape recorder. He tape recorded it, apparently out of paranoia. What I am astounded by is the number of occasions where totally unexpected and startling things happen that the star does nothing at all to conceal. Another interview in this book is with Tony Curtis, also at the Cannes Film Festival. I went to interview him, and during the course of the interview, he looked out the window of his hotel room, saw a woman on the sidewalk that he found attractive, and started screaming at her to come up to his room. He was shouting his name and his room number in full view and hearing of about 500 people on the terrace of the Carlton Hotel. He was really out of control that day. And when I left, I had a very strange encounter to record. most of the time, I think movie stars, now politicians are different. We all know that before the first debate, Mondale and Reagan between them managed to nix something like 98 of the first 100 reporters who were suggested. We don't want that guy. You know, one camp or the other didn't want anyone, right? Movie stars have been interviewed so often that sometimes you find some very revealing things happening because the interviewer is almost not visible to them.
Well, what do you mean?
That there's always been an interviewer there. I mean, Robert Mitchum has been a movie actor for 40 years. If I'm sitting in the backseat of his car, is he going to be thinking, oh, my God, the press is here? No, the press has always been there. You know, 20 years ago it was Rex Reed. 40 years ago it was Luella Parsons. In a way, the press has always been in Robert Mitchum's backseat. And so if you can adopt the fly-on-the-wall approach of just kind of quietly sitting there and observing everything that's going on, you are going to see somebody who is not especially monitoring his behavior.
You have a piece about John Belushi, who grew up in the Chicago area, mm-hmm. where you did, and apparently you knew him before he became a star.
Yes, we were in Old Town at the same time in the early 70s, and there were two pieces in the book, one written a year after he died and one written after the Woodward book came out. And I have some very strong feelings about Belushi and about why he died and about the Woodward book. I think that the problem with Wired, the book by Woodward, is that he treats Belushi like another Watergate defendant, as if he were a criminal of some sort, or an immoral person who was choosing every day to take these drugs or to drink this booze and to disappoint these people or be irresponsible in one way or another. And the book is very factual. You know, like at 3 o'clock on the 3rd of October, he did proceed to ingest cocaine and was not able to go to the set and work. So what? To me, John Belushi was not an immoral person or an irresponsible person or even, and this is very important, a self-destructive person. He was a person with a disease. He had the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. And the reasons why he was doing what he did was that he was addicted to those things, and so therefore, until he found a way to stop, he would continue to do so. I think the great misfortune in Belushi's life is that he was never able to find the kind of treatment that might have worked for him. And Judy Jacklin, was interviewed just the other day in a piece that I was very interested to read because I think she's now coming around to this point of view. She said introspectively, "We went to a lot of doctors, but we never got any advice that helped." And I think that's true. You read that book, and it's just a heartbreaking list of hiring ex-FBI agents as bodyguards to make sure he didn't drink, or I'm going to get away from it all, or maybe if I go to Martha's Vineyard, I can slow down, or I'm only going to drink beer, or I'm only going to drink wine, I'm only going to smoke pot, I'm only going to use a little of this or a little of that, or cocaine isn't addictive. And for John, what he really needed and never, ever got was, first of all, long enough away from the stuff to physically detoxify. Second, long enough away from the stuff to more or less get his psychological bearings back again. And then some sort of follow-through such as Alcoholics Anonymous or something like that. You're never going to be able to get sober with all of these ridiculous self-help theories and willpower and hiring bodyguards to follow you around. I mean, wouldn't it be great? We could each hire a bodyguard today to watch us for the rest of our lives, you know? But what's the point? You've got to be able to live with yourself.
My guest is film critic Roger Ebert, and he has a couple of essays on John Belushi in his new collection of interviews called A Kiss is Still a Kiss. When you go out to Los Angeles to interview a star, do you feel uncomfortable there?
I did. I used to have the received opinion about Los Angeles, you know, suburbs in search of another suburb. I've spent enough time there now, and you always have to drive. You know, you go to the airport and rent a car. If you're going to be in public transportation in Los Angeles, you might as well forget it. I know my way around a little bit more now. It's kind of a hedonistic city. It's very industry-oriented, at least in the areas in which I move. I think it helps me as a movie critic and as an interviewer to live in Chicago, where there is no movie industry at all, and where the same kinds of values are not as important. When I go to Los Angeles, I think I see things sometimes because I'm an outsider. The interview with Michael Caine in the book involves a lot of the tribal behavior at lunch at Ma Maison, a popular restaurant. If I were eating at Ma Maison every day of the week, it would become invisible to me. And so it's important in covering the movie business, I think, to see it freshly, which you can do if you have just come in from 3 months in Chicago. It helps you wonderfully to clear the mind.
Are there movies that you've reviewed during your career that, looking back now, you say to yourself, boy, did I ever call that wrong. I really wish I could rewrite that review.
There have been movies in which my review was pretty wide of the mark. I don't think I've ever been wrong, because I've always tried to express my opinion, and I've always been right since I always knew what I thought. But if you were to go back to 1967 and look at my review of Persona, by the way, which is Bergman's most difficult film, I think, you would find it had been written by a young man who really didn't understand the film. There's nothing inaccurate in the review. There's just that I didn't connect with whatever it was that I now think Bergman was doing. But you do the best that you can, and if you've been honest in your review, people will at least know how you reacted. Then they can go and have their own reaction. And then you get the letters, you know, gee, you missed the point of Persona. And then you write back to them, and you learn that way.
Okay. Do people know how to pronounce your name now that you're on TV? Because I remember the first few times I came across your name, I said, Ebert?
It's one of those names. It's French or it's German, depending upon which side of the mountains you're on. And our family always has said Ebert, but that's a very American pronunciation. It's neither the French nor the German would pronounce it that way.
Do you ever envision yourself giving up TV to work more in writing, or giving up writing to go full-time into TV?
I will never leave a newspaper to go full-time into TV, because I am a newspaper man. That's very important to me psychically. My deadlines, my byline, seeing my stuff in print, this is something tangible, you know. I have also enjoyed television, and on the other hand, what I'm working on now is a novel.
Really?
And we'll see where that goes. But I'm too superstitious about it to tell you anything else but that, because I have this strange feeling that if you talk it out, it'll never be written.
What a break for you. We're out of time, so I can't, I can't ask you. It's really been fun. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Linda.